Welcome to the Exalt Podcast. My name is Christopher Shagnon.
And I'm Sophia Hagalani-Albov. We are so excited to be coming to you today. I'm sure that from the title of this episode, most of our listeners have figured out what this is. But Christopher, what is today?
It is the 2-year anniversary of the Exalt Podcast.
2 years? 2 years have gone by?
2 years, thousands of listens, thousands of hours in people's ears around the world. It's pretty crazy to think back when we were starting that we would get to this point now.
It is pretty exciting. Just a little behind the scenes for some of our listeners. Happy to have you all here, first and foremost. And as Christopher said, we have had thousands of listens over the course of the podcast, which is extremely exciting for us. And at this point, we have had listeners join us from 87 different countries, which is just absolutely mind-blowing. So before we get into the whole conversation that we're about to embark on, I just wanted to take a moment and really appreciate you, the listeners out there, for joining us every month on these explorations and conversations about extractivisms and alternatives, because without your listenership, we would not be here.
Yes, thank you so much, everyone. It's really such a pleasure to do all these things. And, you know, whenever we get feedback or something like that from people, it's a huge boost to the day, to the week, to the month. So if you're enjoying it, please give us a rating on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or Spotify or whatever you're listening on. Maybe leave a comment. It's a huge help for us and for getting the message out there. Again, we don't do this for any money or anything. We do it for pure enjoyment and to just share these amazing conversations with all of you. But if we want to get the conversations out to as many people as possible, that's a great way to help.
Thank you so much for that great reminder, Christopher. So no pressure, but, you know, help us beat the terrible algorithms. Well, without further ado, we would like to introduce our guest, and we are doing something very special today, which is actually a first in the history of the Exalt Podcast. We are very, very fortunate today to be joined by Professor Barry Gills, who, if you remember, was the very first guest of the Exalt Podcast.
Hello, everybody. I'm Barry Gills, and I'm Professor of Global Development Studies at the University of Helsinki and the Faculty of Social Science. And I have was one of the founding members of Exalt, and have seen it grow and develop in remarkable ways. And I'm very pleased to be here with you today to have another conversation.
Thank you so much, Barry. It's always a For those of you at home, Barry is my primary supervisor for my PhD, so I get the fortune of talking with him a bit more than some other people, but it's always a pleasure. And, you know, it's so wonderful to have you back, especially for this like 2-year mark, because, you know, when we were starting this, I mean, I still even remember the first time that we were talking about it. It was like February 2019. And yeah, you were just bringing up kind of this concept, and I was kind of like, maybe seeing like, does data fit into this? I was hearing some other thing, and just going from that conversation and then like you putting Sophia and I in touch about, you know, possibly doing a podcast or something, because we'd both been talking about that. So much has come so far. I mean, both for the initiative and I mean, just looking at the world, and I'm sure I'm not alone in this, but I feel like now more than ever, especially in this COVID world, hopefully soon to be post-COVID world, knock on wood. You know, extractivisms is such a huge thing, so obvious, and is making such an impact. So I guess when you look back at the past 2 years, what's something that really jumps out at you? Let's say first from the initiative.
Well, from the initiative itself, it's remarkable how much has been done. I mean, with a group of wonderful people, staff, volunteers, yourselves, both of you. So much has been done with a small group of people on very small resources, sort of formal resources. And so people have been, you know, sort of self-motivated. And I think people have realized that, you know, the importance, that the key idea that this is such an important area to work on, to do more search, to do more communication with the wider world, to appreciate how important extractivism has become globally, and touching upon so many aspects of life and many disciplines in the social sciences. So I think we had a right instinct a few years ago when we thought, well, look, this is a very important area for us to concentrate on. And I think so far we've done remarkably well with the resources that we've had. And I mean, there's much more to do, obviously. But I think that extractivism has, just in this time we've been working together, it has advanced in terms of people's consciousness of the importance of the concept and the need to bring together many different strands of research that are done in different empirical fields and different case studies, try to understand it as a global phenomena, even a global system, a global mentality, a global regime of accumulation, an embedded structure in global capitalism, which is closely related to the really acute ecological and climate change crisis we're facing now. So I'm encouraged that people are more and more realizing that this is a field which needs our full attention.
Absolutely. And I mean, of course, here we definitely agree. I know that there's been so much, you were talking about the initiative and the growing global importance of extractivism as a concept. How do you think the pandemic has played into kind of this raised awareness of extractivism as a concept?
Well, there's been a great deal of commentary and also scientific evidence published about the connection between the destruction of habitat and ecosystem harm, damage, elimination, and human intrusion into more and more sort of ecozones and habitats where we had little real contact before, and placing many, many species under increasing pressure. So zoonotic a matrix of how humans can be exposed to new diseases from this contact, which is part of the global extractivism consequences. So I actually think that this is now very widely understood. And I was like, the basic point has been across the planet and has become now, in a sense, just normalized, that people realize, yes, there is a direct connection between the human onslaught on ecosystems and species. What Jamie Morgan and I have just called in a new essay in Globalizations, the war on nature by the human species in our present forms of social organization, economic practice. So that's something that has advanced during this period. I mean, along with the many other aspects of embedded global inequality increasing suffering and poverty that this system has imposed on people during the pandemic, that's not exactly, extractivism itself. But, you know, the crisis has revealed, the COVID crisis has revealed many sort of key aspects of the global system as a whole.
Absolutely. And I mean, I feel like it's been such, I mean, of course, you know, this has been something that's been increasing for years and everything, but I really feel like the past couple of years in particular, we've seen such an increase. We've been seeing, of course, debated in the West more than anywhere else, but like going towards a Green New Deal, which some, especially more towards the center, have as a magic wand for all these problems. But then at the same time, we also see the incredible extractivism that as well causes, like looking at the coup in Bolivia that was happening, seemingly very much related to lithium extraction, looking at the COP reports and just so much coming forward. And I think as well, you know, your point on COVID being related to this, I mean, even if we, of course, no one's 100% sure where it came from, but if it did come from some sort of animal farming or something like that, the inhumane treatment of non-humans in tight spaces and creating these sorts of environments where a virus like this can breed. So I guess with all of this, I mean, this is a huge question, but if you could pick like one big thing that jumps to your mind of, let's say, the COVID time that really exemplifies how extractivism is coming out, of course, I mean, beyond spread of COVID, what do you think it would be?
Well, since you started out by talking about, you know, people's aspirations to find a green way forward. I have been thinking that there really is something very important going on in terms of human collective learning, the change in human consciousness, the change in human mentality and understanding about the human relationship with the other than human world, the web of life. I've been hoping in all of my life that I would see this kind of change in human attitudes, broadly speaking, towards what we often used to call, or maybe some still do, nature, that we would transcend the old dualism that was so dominant and in a way is underlying extractivist mentality, that you know, nature is simply a dead, desacralized zone of objects. It's been objectified to just mere things that are there as a utility for human beings to exploit as we will. And I do really think that there's been a growing sense of a realization, might call it, amongst a very large number of people, so until it becomes a historical material force for transformation, that this must be changed. You know, that human beings are embedded in the web of life completely, and that we have been lacking in an understanding of the violence we do to all the other beings, and ultimately, therefore, to ourselves. And I am really optimistic that this is going to be a profound change, and it will determine much of the future of what we do as we transform our societies into something new and, I think, far more sane and compassionate, viable. You know, so I'm actually looking forward to this. And I'm hoping it's going to grow in strength. And I'm fairly confident that it will continue to increase and have an effect, real effects.
Related to this, one of the things that I know that we've talked about before, and also Barry is not my supervisor for my doctoral dissertation, but I do have the pleasure of working with him quite often. So there have been many off-the-air conversations. So please forgive me that I am now going to pull up something from an off-the-air conversation to ask about that we can talk about here. But I do believe it's related to this larger vein of what we're talking about. But one of the things that I know you've really brought to the fore within the Exalt Initiative is the idea of extractivism as an organizing concept. And I was hoping that you could help to unpack that a little bit for us and tell us a bit about what that means.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. Well, maybe I should go back in time, because what moved me to think about that, you know, an organizing concept, was because some decades ago, some of us were very much talking about hegemony in international political economy and what hegemony meant. And there was a whole set of discussions and roundtables and publications around reinterpreting hegemony in the world. And then came globalization. And that we, you know, again, we could see that, well, now there's another change. There's an organizing concept which has emerged. How do we engage with it? What's our response? What questions will we ask? What new research agendas will we set? Because the organizing concepts do that. And sometimes they are, you know, they arise and then they have their role for a while, and then they may, you know, sort of kind of fade a bit. I've seen that happen in my time over the decades. And so I had the sense, and I think many of us now do, that extractivism but actually leaping over to global extractivism would be a candidate to be considered as a new organizing concept in the social sciences. And so, I mean, it was Wallerstein, I think, who defined an organizing concept as a central concept upon which many other concepts hinge. And so we developed this idea in our working group some time ago at Helsinki, that it was an ensemble. An organizing concept doesn't operate singly, solely, only you know, one single concept. It forms a kind of pivot where you put together a great number of related concepts, either that enable it, that help define it, or that are part of its consequences or manifestations. So you begin to see a much larger picture, a very complex set of relationships of, I mean, at the intellectual level of concepts, which you can then begin to see that, well, maybe this is the whole thing is almost like a system. And so what extractivism does as an organizing concept is it opens up new insights, because you're enabled to see things in somewhat different way than you did under a previous organizing concept, like, for example, globalization. And I think that we've been basically on the right track about that. And that for our time, the time we are living in, this time of multiple crises, of ecological degradation and destruction and global warming and all that entails, that this is a concept for our time. So it's also part of relevance, not just mere topicality or interest, or, you know, that it looks fascinating because it somehow has some intellectual interest for us. It's beyond that. This is very closely tied to the manner in which things are unfolding in our time globally. So I think that's proven to be correct. You know, I think we have been trying to make a viable argument. People will see forthcoming work, hopefully fairly soon, about global extractivism as an organizing concept, and all the various fields to which it speaks and engages, and in what manner. You know, so I think that it's right. I do see, and I have more and more kind of confidence that global extractivism is a very important organizing concept now in the social sciences.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's quite amazing now when looking at all this. I think even of the other day, I went for a walk with a friend, and, you know, they're asking about, like, my research and everything. And I started talking about extractivisms, and I was like, well, what's that? And so I explained it. I mean, going back to the point of view of mining, of course, where, like, you know, as you know, but our listeners hopefully know by now, or possibly know by now, coming out of that sort of lens of looking at mining and then expanding to other areas. And when I was talking with them about it, they were instantaneously able to get what I was talking about with an example, even if they didn't know the term extractivism or extractivisms. But it was also interesting in how we got into a conversation of, to them, they were like, yeah, but that's just kind of the way it is. That's the way the world works, and acted in this way, like as if it's always been that way, as if it's, you know, just sort of a natural thing. You know, that's the system. You want to get as much out as you can. That's the logic of it. Why wouldn't you? And, you know, one of those things that I really appreciate from that course and how we all got to discuss things was looking at how extractivism isn't a new thing at all, or even a unique thing to neoliberal global capitalism, but is an embedded thing in it, and an embedded thing in other systems. I mean, looking at, you know, quote unquote, communism, or going back to colonialism and even ancient imperialism, and bringing out those discussions of even looking back at, like, ancient Greece and ancient Rome and the colonies that they built. And, well, what was the reason for that? And I feel like it's such an important concept. And one of the reasons I feel that extractivism is so important versus just looking at global capitalism, which, you know, that's important too, but is that it does span time, and it has exacerbated over time. And I think that having this sort of nuance, looking at the destruction that comes from the motivation to extract and from extracting, not simply using the resources, but from the extraction specifically, gives us this sort of nuance to be able to tackle these issues from multiple angles rather than just trying to tackle all the problems of, like, global capitalism all at once.
Well, you know, I've spent part of my life trying to study world historical processes going back millennia and developing a kind of new perspective in world system analysis, world system theory. But so, of course, I do see extractivist practices going back millennia. And maybe they are aspects of the forms of civilization, the state, urbanism, empire building, class society. So yeah, there are many forms of extraction of value, but there has been this human relationship through what, you know, we generally call the history of civilization and its expansion, and thus also, from my kind of perspective, the world system. that there have certainly been extractivist practices embedded in it throughout its history, which are intrinsic to the system. However, I think we all know, and a good deal of empirical work has shown that there has been, even though Marx wrote about the metabolic rift or the metabolic shift, depending on whether you read Bellamy Foster or Jason Moore, but the nevertheless, you know, the idea that that human extraction of resources, again inverted commas, resources from multiple ecosystems, the scale of it and the intensity of it, the magnitude of it, has had a historic leap. Okay, there may have been one iteration or inflection point 200 years ago with industrialization, the onset of fossil fuels, huge amounts of expansion through colonialism and imperialism around the world, led by the center powers, imperial powers. But in the last 40 to 50 years, we've seen another leap. And you can, it's measurable through material throughput. I've seen some of those figures and those kind of charts, and it's remarkable, right? And that's celebrated as a great success. You know, the system is succeeding. It's producing unprecedented amounts of goods and services, wealth and value, accumulation of capital. You know, it's colossally successful. But as I often say, when development becomes so destructive, then much of what we have called development should be called maldevelopment. And we've now reached a point in human history and the human relationship with the web of life that the realization has sunk in, that the various limits have been crossed, the thresholds have been crossed. And we are now in a rather perilous position. So what was seen by especially certain kinds of neoliberal triumphalists as the most remarkable vindication of the system is seen by vast numbers of us critics as something far more problematic. And I think that's now even becoming a more general common sense. A perception that we're right, and I think amongst young people it's an acute perception. Look, this is so destructive now that we cannot imagine this continuing, and it's an existential threat if it does. So extractivism, yes, for millennia, yes, but also inflection points, and that's part of our that is part of the story of colonialism, imperialism, capitalism, neoliberalism, globalization, up until the present time, and with an intensification that was just astonishing just over the past several decades.
Sometimes it's almost hard to imagine, like, if these systems are set up to continue to become more and more intense, like, where could we go from here in terms of intensification? It's already so, as you were saying, just so destructive. I also think that one of the things that has really helped to bring this sense to the forefront is, and this is one of those, double-edged swords, because it's also in and of itself a very destructive force, but I think the increase in communication and visual communication, maybe 50 years ago, there were really intense mining processes going on, but they could more easily be hidden, out of sight, out of mind. But I think that in this current era that we're living in, with all the ability to capture image and sound and like really capture the visceral experiences, and share them across the world of what it's like to be at these extractive frontiers, I think has also really helped to bring it out of the shadows a bit. Like, this stuff is really happening and you can't hide it because I can take a picture of it and share it.
I think that's very true. And so that now, you can see and communicate across the experiences from what some of us, like our colleague Marcus Kroeger in Exalt, are calling, zones of sacrifice zones, and other scholars have called it that, I think, Marisol de la Cadena and others, sacrifice zones, which is a pretty provocative kind of concept. You know, because sacrifice has a great many really profound meanings for us in our culture. It brings acutely the point of that, like, well, how many of these sites are out there? How extensive is this phenomenon? Which is why, of course, we've been attracted to the idea of theorizing around global extractivism. You see a much wider pattern, phenomena. Like you say, you might see a conflict in one site or two sites, but then you begin to realize that there may be at any particular time hundreds of such sites where there's a social conflict around the imposition or expansion of an extractivist project to the people who inhabit that place and call it home. And then also often now increasingly are aware of the fact that they very consciously are defending not only themselves, their language, their culture, their life, their livelihood, their well-being, but also all the beings and the ecosystem complexity, biodiversity, and so on around them. And in a way that they're doing that on behalf of all. And again, some of them are quite conscious about that. You know, that we need your support. We need your solidarity. We need your understanding. And you need to be knowledgeable about what's happening to us and help us. Because as we defend ourselves, we defend you. It's like Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. once said, injustice anywhere is injustice everywhere. Or, you know, what happens to one happens to all, for whom the bell tolls. So it is like that now, you know, that which is I think a great change recently, you know, to realize that look, this really is a global system phenomenon, and now we now have the capability to understand it like that, and to aggregate all these different cases into a new kind of complex understanding about what's happening. So the visibility is extremely important, and of course it's been enabled by our technology, and people are using it. Really effectively and constantly, and it's more so like right now the front lines in the Amazon region, you know, it maybe in the past that some of it has been happening for since centuries. But just now there's more capability to understand and ally with the groups that are at the sharp end, that are really in what you might call on the front line. And those groups themselves are bringing each other together in much wider constellations of groups who see themselves as the defenders, you know. So all of that I find is very, very positive, you know, that reflects horrific phenomena of conflict and destruction that are going on. At the same time, there's something quite promising about it in another way, of how human beings unite in common values and common cause to the same ends.
Absolutely. And I'm going to hop around here to go back to a few different points. I think something someone brought up before when you're talking about like the younger generations now. I mean, and I totally agree. When you look at we could say Gen Z, or you know, the people who are now getting into starting undergraduate, I think they call it people born since like 1997 to like maybe 2015 or something. You know, it is really a remarkable difference. I mean, compared to looking at people in my and Sophia's generation, the so-called millennials, in that, you know, there are people in our generation who are definitely becoming much more active, much more interested, but there's also a pretty big split in that there's also a lot of people who are going the exact opposite way and feeling very entrenched in the system, which I feel like you don't see with Gen Z as much. I feel like Gen Z is much more seeing what's going on in terms of ecocide and the destruction of the planet and questioning the future, you know, rather than being like, no, it's fine. Climate change isn't real. So I do appreciate that. And I think that's one of the greatest things of being at the university right now is, you know, as much as some people might be like, it's an indoctrination for, you know, leftist thinking or something, like, really, I feel like the students are more coming in with it towards me than I'm giving anything towards them, which is pretty amazing. And I think as well, you know, and another comment, when we look at social media and the ability to share this stuff, and I think this plays into what I was just saying too, is there is this aspect that it's so much easier to share than ever. But also social media and everything has put us to a situation where it's so much easier to steep people in these false sort of myths that everything's fine. And I think that's one of those divides that we see, especially in the media and social media, of people being like, sharing a bunch of fake science or conspiracy theories and stuff like that, that push against this stuff and finding a sort of head in the sand comfort in that. So like with all of this stuff, it is a double-edged sword in itself. It's providing undeniable proof that we were never able to see before. But at the same time, it's providing a space and surrounding for people to deny undeniable proof in a way that we've never seen before. And getting back to the final point, this increase in global solidarity and awareness and defenders. And I think that is such an amazing thing too, and the increased ability to do this. And I think at the same time, it's also laying bare the gap between actions and words of our leaders. When you look at we look at the Amazon, and of course, Bolsonaro has never pretended to be pro Amazon, but we look at the people there and we look back at, say, Standing Rock in the US with the oil pipeline. And I believe that Obama was still president then. And great words for the country about how we need to protect the environment and things. But at the same time, too, not actually taking the forceful measures to stop militarized police from forcing a pipeline through indigenous lands. It's like it lays bare this kind of having your cake and eating it, too, of a lot of leaders who try to look good, but don't seem to have as much interest in the type of change and hard decisions that are necessary. And I realize that's a whole lot of thoughts and everything.
One thought about that is the power of the fossil fuel industry as a whole and its influence to capture governments in its own interest to prevent kinds of legislation that would curtail some of their worst practices, which is now increasingly well known about how some of the major fossil fuel interests have been doing so for several decades, having had their own research tell them what the scenario would be on a business as usual, their business model over the decades. They knew what would be coming in decades to come in terms of global warming and its effects. Some of them have been instead of trying to adjust radically to prevent this catastrophe, they have done the opposite. They try to defer and deflect and spread doubt and delay and obstruct any radical change to their business model. So this is a huge vested interest globally. There are a great many oil exporting countries. And much of it is also state owned in many of those cases, and governments depending on the revenue. So, the point is that we cannot, in a way, underestimate how important that power is and how they can influence politicians, even against the overwhelmingly expressed will of their own people. I think this is the case currently in Australia, that the clear overwhelming majority of Australians want some decisive action on climate change and fossil fuels. And yet the government reigning might not be complying with what is, rather obviously the will of the people, one might say. And that's not the only case. It's maybe too many cases of the same on internally contradictory actions, So this is all part and parcel of what's going on. This is about confronting the power of the fossil fuel industries and their power over governments is part of the struggle that's going on globally right now, and perhaps even at the center of it. And that we'll see in Glasgow with COP26, that certain interests will have done all they could, what one might say, or we assume they have, to try to limit what's done to control their activities. One of the key things right now that needs to happen, that acutely needs to happen, is there needs to be a global campaign with all speed and urgency to stop methane leaks by fossil fuel extraction all over the planet. It's one of the previously unseen enormous polluting effects of the whole fossil fuel extraction industry, and nothing's been done about it. In fact, you know, there's been a lot of effort by that lobby representing those interests to prevent anything being done about it. And so now there, at least there's some traction and momentum globally to say, well, this is one thing which has to happen immediately. You know, they have to be regulated and compelled to stop these leaks in their operations all over the planet as quickly as possible. We have evidence to show how important right now that truly is. You know, it could make a huge difference to our prospects of keeping things to, you know, below 2 degrees centigrade in the coming decade, or at most 2. So things like that. And the other thing I just want to mention is I just saw a recent opinion poll in Britain, where I live, of young people, of youth. And interestingly, clearly more than 2/3 of them believe that climate crisis is an expression of global capitalism. And also that 2/3 and more of them want to live in a socialist society. Yeah. So, you know, as you're saying, like the younger generation right now have had a steep learning curve about the destructive side of the present global capitalist and extractivist system. And they are looking for some real alternatives, not just a little, you know, reformist tinkering around here and there. You know, they want something that they think is actually going to make a break, a profound and true break with the underlying causes of our crises. So, you know, people are now commonly quoting that phrase that's attributed to Einstein, that you cannot solve a problem using the same methods and means that produced the problem in the first place. And I think that has sunk in. And that's why, you know, this slogan, you know, system change, not climate change, is a slogan, right? Because it's lacking of content in a way, you know, which is all important. But the sense that, look, the system we've got is broken and dangerous and has to be stopped on its path to our, you know, calamity. So that opens the mind to a paradigm shift. So what other people, I think, are increasingly interested, young people, or what are the alternatives? What are the radical alternatives? What are the real transformatory alternatives? And those can come in myriad forms, as we know in our initiative. That's why we call it Global Extractivism and Alternatives. Yeah, you know, that the alternatives are the other aspect of the same. The alternatives, in a way, are being accelerated, generated, and realized by and through the response to learning about the source of the crises. So I anticipate that's only going to become more and more and more prevalent. And we'll see how all these, you know, the impetus and desire for radical alternatives plays out over the coming decade. It may lead in some unanticipated, unexpected directions. We have to see how it has as these things develop, but particularly if there turns out to be a huge disappointment globally in what the elite of the world and the governments decide to do about these problems next month. That may then, you know, that might cause certain kinds of, you know, further reflections about what kinds of actions are effective and what kinds aren't, and what roads are open or necessary to actually get things to change, because, you know, the stakes are so high. This is a force in history that people, you know, things could get much more radical much more quickly than some people expect.
I think those are like such a beautiful way of kind of summing up some of these like currents that are running right now, especially bringing to the fore like the powers behind the powers, because I mean, we sometimes, you know, we think, oh, of course, the government, that's the power, but there's something behind it too, you know, like through lobbying and all that. And I have to admit, like, as I'm listening, I'm getting that, you know, clenched chest of like, oh my God, the like eco anxiety, the climate anxiety, how are we going to get out of this? So I think this highlighting of alternatives is really important as a, you know, something that we have to remember, that while these extractivisms, you know, there's so much focus on them and we're seeing them, and, you know, it kind of goes along with the adage, you know, if it bleeds, it leads in news reporting. So it's like the extractivisms, you know, it's very interesting to talk about them and very emotionally charged. And I think that sometimes the alternatives do get a little bit pushed to the side. So I'm really glad that you've brought it back into our conversation, you know, because we are extractivisms and alternatives, and those transformative alternatives, it's not something that we have to, well, I don't know how to say this exactly right, but we don't have to like create them. There's not a void there. The transformative alternatives are there. Mm-hmm. It's about finding them, highlighting them, connecting them.
Yes, I think that's very, very true. They are there. And I think that's going to be ever more so. I mean, at least the people that I tend to hear from, communicate with, pay attention to, there are just so many people with their will set on finding real alternatives in their own life, in the way they live, and also collectively with projects, community projects, political projects, you know, so many different kinds. But they just seem to be everywhere. So that's very encouraging. And I say, just on the kind of reformist level, one of the things that is being proposed at the COP26 is there is some prospect that new agreements could be reached to regulate global supply chains in order to try to get a grip on reducing the deforestation, for example, and other forms of real ecological harm, and also labor exploitation. At the base, different elements, particularly kind of sites of extraction, at the base of global value chains. So that's important, right? There's so many different scales and arenas in which these what we could call alternatives to the present practices are emerging. Everything from a small community project, to create a forest garden, or something like that. There's so many ways you could mention, or even like whole regional autonomy crop projects like Zapatistas or Rojava, others in other parts of the world, to these, global scale, in a way, global governance, international treaty-based regulatory changes. But what you're saying before is one of the key elements as well is finance, is to regulate the banks and other financiers, private equity, investors with capital who, we know that we even have studies now showing how the major banks in the world measure up against the need to stop investment in new fossil fuel projects. And the record is appalling in a way. Since the Paris Agreement, just vast sums of hundreds of billions have continued to be advanced and invested by the banks in what? In new fossil fuel projects. So, again, there's an acute need right there that has to happen. It really has to happen very soon, that there be a new international treaty which will force banks to curtail this, if not stop it. And actually major authoritative bodies are calling for that, like the International Energy Agency basically, shocked a lot of people and said straight out not very long ago, very recently, that all new investment in fossil fuels must stop. It must stop. So the signals are changing in that way. So in a way, okay, so things are in motion. Alternatives at all levels of the existing system. Depends on, and so individuals can decide where to put their energy and their will. And again, I'm not one of these who believes in the either or, that it's either the individual or the collective. I think it's a both and for us all. That's what I advocate, that each of us need to scrutinize our how we exist in this world and all the implications going right back to the sites of extraction, right through the global supply chains. We need, and all of our emissions and pollution, our waste, our consumption, we do. We each need realizing that, what one person does might not seem amount to a hill of beans in the world, as they say, or not be important. But if a billion people make the same choice and make the same change, and it's in a direction that, say, reduces their destruction of ecosystems and pollution, contributing to global warming, that's a material change. That constitutes social change. So I see it as combined. Like each individual all over the world has now a responsibility to scrutinize everything they do, to reflect on their life and how they live in relation to all the other life on Earth. Because that's what this new profound philosophical change means, which is ancient wisdom. And in many peoples around the world, indigenous peoples are now, you know, being more recognized for having retained a core of those values, or many of them have, or they're articulating them better now. People are hearing it, you know. But that doesn't preclude the necessity of collective and political action. It's necessary. It's imperative. If we don't see very large scale collective political global governance changes soon, then you know we're still in dire straits. You know, it's the sine qua non of our way out of this, I think. So, you know, some people say, oh, you know, individual action alone won't achieve anything. Yeah. And it'll only be collective action. Well, again, I don't see it like that, as I was just saying. I believe that it's imperative to do both. Every single individual will be both collectively and individually acting as best they can. But making their own choice, where they have their emphasis, where they have their interests, where they have a possibility, you know, where they have a community of people to work with, and, you know, all of that. That each individual is different and have their own life history about that.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think that there's so much there. I mean, looking at the importance of that self-reflection, and I think that's one of the toughest things, really. I mean, for individuals generally, but I think perhaps it could be a thing of modern society, it could be a thing of humanity. People don't necessarily like self-reflection. It is something that is difficult. It is something that really needs to be learned in many ways. Being self-critical. And I think that's one of those important things too, which even like can scare people in this stuff. And it can be really scary to realize how much you yourself have contributed to this system, even if you're not leading it. And, you know, it can be easier to run away from that than face it. And especially, I think that's one of those things, though, of, you know, finding that balance between like the systemic level, of course, you know, looking at all the how much corporations do, looking at how much the military does. I mean, my God. Yes. But as well, you know, focusing on the individual too, and realizing that like self-reflection and realizing that you might have not done things well isn't necessarily your fault. You can feel bad for it, but the big thing is to like do it and see the areas that you can change and move forward to try to stop it. And I think that's one of those things that people always lose in that sort of self-reflection. There's a lot of, especially I feel like the opponents of change try to cast change as a thing of shame. Don't listen to them because they're telling you that you have always been wrong and you are bad, rather than saying like, you know, we can change how we're doing things and, you know, we all messed up. So let's accept it, try to do something different and move on. And I think that that is a very useful, well, I mean, I think that that casting of shame, is a very useful preventative tool that keeps the system kind of going, that keeps people just sort of in this delayed talking. And I think, like, you know, when you look at finance and stuff like that, I think you made a fantastic point there. I mean, you know, when we look at, you know, the Pandora Papers having just come out and the incredible amount of finance there and all the shady dealings.
Those who control capital have some of the greatest power to shape the future. That's, you know, right. So it's, you know, follow the money. And the, you know, so far, you know, the doctrine of you know, government saying we don't want to interfere too much with the workings of the financial markets, you know, I think that by necessity that's going to change. I mean, in terms of, you know, in terms of the military aspect of this, the Transnational Institute has just updated a report of theirs, which you can find on the TNI website, Transnational Institute in Amsterdam. But, you know, there's some worrying trends out there where some people are arguing, well, you know, maybe we'll have to have, you know, we'll advocate or accept military intervention in order to, you know, to address some of the issues of climate change, you know, to prevent some of the worst abusers. Maybe it'll, you know, it's kind of like revisiting the doctrine a couple of decades and more back about humanitarian interventionism and what that led to and why people were skepticism of that. Some of us were when it was first mooted, you know, that well, hold on. That's a very, very dangerous road to think that the way we'll deploy or address the military aspect of this is to utilize the military in interventionism and just bring people's attention. Pay attention to that, and I hope you'll oppose it on principle that no, any military interventions, they should not be seen as any kind of viable response to this, because the dangers are just too great when you start unleashing that kind of thing. You know, more to the point, as you were just saying, Chris, is that the military institutions around the world, unfortunately, the phase we're in world system dynamics right now is that military budgets are increasing. And not only that, but there's fear of, you know, the unleashing of a new nuclear arms race phase, and a dangerous one because of the nature of the type of weapons that are being developed, which are more, in a sense, theater weapons that could be used in war. And, you know, that's the same. That came around a few decades ago. Battlefield weapons, nuclear weapons, mini nuclear weapons, you know, MINI, mini, small battlefield theater nuclear weapons. And the idea, then you make the threshold between conventional war and nuclear war very, very fuzzy indeed. And so it's extraordinarily dangerous, and many people have been commenting on it. The Bulletin of Concerned Asian Scholars are extremely concerned about it right now, but you know, others around the world, that CIPRI or others that document this kind of thing. And the militaries themselves, what we need in the, you know, they are, as you said, some of the most important polluters on the planet in the midst of this crisis, but very little attention has been placed upon them. You know, upon those institutions and how they need to have their own plans to radically move away from their dependence on fossil fuels. In a way, it's kind of perverse connection that, you know, you have the fossil fuel industry writ large around the planet, or upon which we're still dependent for over 80 to even up to 90% of our base energy around the planet. And that system is, you know, kind of overlaid with a military system, which is tied up with it so intricately, you can almost not put them apart. You're defending the defense of the resources so that the extraction can continue, the oil can flow, the gas can flow, the governments can be supported by the revenue, et cetera, et cetera. You know, this needs to be better understood. So I've long advocated the need for radical disarmament. It goes back to this may seem old, but I think it's more important now than ever that, you know, we have to make the call jointly that, look, we not only need to, defossilize the fuel element here, decarbonize, a better term, but we also need to demilitarize and disarm. And so we're going in the opposite direction right now, which is very dangerous and also wasteful, because you're talking vast sums of money. Money is not infinite in that sense. There's always a question of resource allocation. And right now on this planet, I really would say that, it is quite unfortunate and dangerous that more and more resources are poured into advancing expansion of military apparatus and nuclear weapons. This is, in a way, almost madness in the present circumstances. If you think about it, like in terms of collective rationality, it's not rational. And maybe it's a system logic, which, you know, is of great concern. International relations theorists try to understand that. But I think there needs to, once again, a revival of the global peace movement as part of the response to the crisis. And they've got to demand that governments sit down at the table and write and come up with a new comprehensive agreement about phased mutual reductions in the military spending. And actually, it needs to be steep. It needs to be radical. And as the spending goes down and the expansion go down, so will their pollution go down, one would think. And also that they should be mandated by governments to decarbonize radically and quickly. But this demand is not strong enough right now. It's sort of obscured and, you know, maybe seen as something that people don't want to deal with. But as you say, it's there and it's huge and it needs to be dealt with.
I think that is such an important point. In this modern era, we have so much knowledge now about what is going on, and we can find out these underlying dynamics that we don't have the luxury to not take action. And I really appreciate, going back to what we were talking about earlier, I really appreciate your point of that it's not just individual action or communal action, you know, but that it's both. It's an and both. We need individual action and communal action if we're going to start to unravel some of these webs of extraction. And yeah, I mean, it's a big task. Like I said, that eco anxiety and anxiety about the overarching world situation, definitely, like, my throat tightens as, you know, we think about these things, but it is so important that just because it's uncomfortable to have to deal with some of these problems, that we take the opportunity to sit in that discomfort and hopefully use it as a motivator for a positive change.
Yeah, I can only agree strongly with that. You know, we have the burden of knowledge, in fact, in our generation, our time. And such an availability of knowledge, of information. But I mean, I see that, again, as I'm fond of saying, along with many others, that we live in an extraordinary time of communication and reflexivity that is technologically mediated like never before, and annihilating space and time and so on, compressing, use those concepts before from literature from Giddens and others some time ago. But this is so, but like for human learning, for like the ability to respond, to learn, and then to act, and to act in a new way, to act differently, also to act collectively at global scale, even in ways that are really actually meaningful, that, you know, they're quite large scale. And that even can be seen then as even successes, you know, because there are successes at global scale when people have come together and campaigned on a particular problem and have an effective outcome about it. So, you know, this is our greatest advantage historically right now, is that we do have unprecedented information and possibilities of reflexivity and then learning and responding differently. And it's happening. So that, to me, what optimism we may have right now rests in that process, as far as I am concerned.
Thank you so much for that. And, you know, I completely agree. And, you know, I'm so glad to bring back in that sort of message of hope for the future. But unfortunately, you know, we've been talking for some time now, and I've been absolutely loving it, loving all the directions we're going in. But we know that, you know, you've got to get about your day, and, you know, there's so much going on. So we're getting to the point where we get to every episode where something happens.
Something happens? Like, what do you mean? Like, what happens?
That is a great question.
Is it time for the question?
It is time for the question.
So, every episode, we like to ask our guests the question, which is, for our listeners at home, it's a sort of call to action. It could be a wide variety of things, that whatever you think they can do, but, you know, it could be something that they could change in their daily lives. It could be something that they read. It could be someplace they donate. But it's something that your, say, quote-unquote, average person listening at home could do today or tomorrow to make a difference, to learn something more, to be part of doing it better. So I guess that is the question. What could you advise for our listeners at home?
Right, Chris and Sophia, that's a real challenge, that question. So amongst the many things I might say, I would advocate that people in a serious way start to look into the concept of degrowth and see degrowth not as some crazy idea, which means we're all going to be poor. And so it's something kind of impossible or certainly not desirable. Actually, open your mind up and see it as realistic, the viable way forward. We are overproducing, overconsuming, overextracting, overpolluting, particularly the richest parts of the world. Of course, I know there's class inequality throughout all parts of the world, but generally, the figures when they're aggregated show that, you know, those people who live in the so-called global north, and especially amongst the affluent classes, are doing the most. They're responsible for most of the extraction, most of the consumption, most of the waste, most of the pollution, and it cannot go on like that. And certainly it implies global injustice if you're still, you know, denying the possibilities of vast billions of people out there in the world who are still suffering with deprivation or poverty, or, you know, they need to be assisted to move on. and actually genuinely better their life. So degrowth, you know, it can be about a better life. And that's including, you know, just the sense of us in the wealthy North, not a life that's impoverished in various ways, but is actually enriched and made better. Also as a kind of imperative of our time, because we cannot proceed further along this exponential, endless exponential material economic growth on a finite planet, which is under kind of breaking point stress ecologically. Penny has to drop and people have to realize. So there's now a burgeoning field of work around the concept of degrowth. You know, thousands of people are involved in trying to discuss it, define it, lay out its contours, and so on. So I would just say that if there's one thing, you know, that you can start to educate yourself more about and get engaged with is this discussion around degrowth, because in my view, degrowth needs to become a kind of central project for us in the global North, and seen as really that our own experience of well-being will increase and the whole societal well-being will increase, and it will ease so much of the pressure on the ecological systems on which we depend and which we're embedded in also. So it's like one of the most promising concepts out there. So please do find out more about it and become engaged with it, maybe be active with it in your own way as practice. You know, praxis. And I think the time of degrowth has come.
That is such a wonderful answer to such a tough question, because I know that there's so many different directions that one could go with that question. So I think that was just a fantastic answer. Now, along those lines, there are a few things that we're going to link for our listeners down in the show notes. For example, that TNI report that you mentioned, Marcus's book that you mentioned, and of course, we will make sure to link to the new piece in Globalizations that you and Jamie Morgan have written. Is there anything else that you would like our listeners specifically to have a link to in the show notes?
Oh, well, thanks. Actually, that postscript about cop in or cop out, you know, the end of the war on nature that Jamie and I did is part of a special issue, a very large one on economics and climate emergency. It's all free access. Every single piece is either open access or free access. So they could look at the whole special issue and see if what they find there of interest. And there's a piece by Jason Hickel, for example, on understanding degrowth. If you go to that special issue, which is out now, you probably find something interesting, I hope.
Wonderful. So we'll make sure to link that down below. So if any of our listeners are piqued by that little preview we just got, please find the link for that special issue in Globalizations below.
Thanks so much for having me today. And you know, and us is a celebration of Exalt and of your podcast. And you've done all the brilliant work you've done with this podcast. So I'm just grateful that you had me on. We had an opportunity to think about some of these things again together. And I hope the listeners have benefited by or enjoyed what we've been talking about, and maybe follow through on some aspects that interested them.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Barry. It's you know, always a pleasure, but you know, so great to have you back and have you as our first repeat guest. You know, looking forward to the next time and to many more anniversaries of Exalt in the podcast in the future.
Yes, wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us today. And also, as Christopher said, and we've said a few times, it is this anniversary. So I just want to make sure also to thank you to Christopher for being just a super fantastic co-host and now also a friend. We came together over this podcast initially, and it's just been such a delight over the last, it's actually been 2.5 years behind the scenes, but 2 years public facing. But yeah, it's just been such a pleasure, and I'm really excited for season 3.
Absolutely. And thank you so much too, Sophia. You know, it's been, you know, this has become my favorite thing that I do. It's, you know, it's so much fun getting to talk with you and talk with all of our guests in this. And it's been so enriching. And yeah, you know, in this time, you know, you've become like one of my absolute best friends. So I feel very grateful both in work and life for all of this. And yeah, so thank you. And thanks to everyone at home for listening. We're really looking forward to, jumping into season 3 and getting some new stuff out there on the horizon. A huge thank you to Barry Gills for coming on and having that wonderful conversation with us to celebrate 2 years of the Exalt podcast. Please join us next month when we'll be talking with Antti Tarvainen,
about settler colonialism and its impacts on the tech sectors in the U.S. and Israel. From the gray skies and bright leaves of Helsinki, Finland, I am Christopher Shagnon. On behalf of Sophia Hagelani-Elbov, thanks for listening. Stay safe. Catch you next season.